Lee with Truth News Radio Australia, beaming out to you on the 27th of November 2013. Welcome to another show, ladies and gentlemen. Well, I have a really important guest today, and I'm very privileged and honoured to be able to bring to you the legendary filmmaker John Pilger, who is going to be talking to us about his latest film project, and I'm also hoping to talk about some of the broader issues about truth in media and what is really going on in terms of the way information is being disseminated on this planet. John Pilger, welcome to Truth News Radio.
Oh, thank you. I'm sorry, but you have to turn down the...
Oh, I'm terribly sorry. Yes, we'll turn that music down a little. It sometimes actually overwhelms the audio. Welcome to the show. Look, I know you're very busy, so we won't keep you too long, but I'd like to start with your latest film, Utopia, which you've had a career in really deeply criticising many aspects of Australian culture and a lot of what is going on in the world in terms of our inherent racism. And what I find about your work that's also really important is that you relate that back to a problem in our society which is really neither of the left or the right. It's a very, very deep problem. It seems to be a problem that we see globally as well. And I'd like to get into all of that. But if you can actually start with talking about this new film that you've just produced and its background and what it contains.
Well, Utopia is the fourth film I've made in Indigenous Australia. The first one was The Secret Country in 1985. And what I wanted to do was to go back to some of the places that I'd filmed back then, meet again some of the people I'd interviewed, and see just really what had changed. That was one aspect of it. I also wanted to just look at how the media especially plays a significant role in the popular portrayal of Indigenous people. People from outside Australia are often very puzzled about why Australians, non-Indigenous Australians, seem to reserve a particular almost animosity for the First People. It's not down to people who might be called rednecks. It's people of quite enlightened persuasion often have this almost a block about Aboriginal people. And you mentioned in your introduction the racism that runs through Australian society, that's often expressed about the Indigenous people, and of course it's expressed in the political impositions and social engineering and exploitation of Indigenous people as well. So Utopia really examines those elements, and I think, again, as you mentioned, it's a universal story. It's about what has become a kind of international apartheid, the word borrowed from South Africa, an apartheid between classes and people of race, racial difference, mainly apartheid between the rich and the poor, and between those who are prepared to conform to a kind of ideological and material doctrine or comfort, and those who are not. And that's very much expressed in the story of the Indigenous people of Australia.
Indeed. And, you know, one thing that that I've certainly noticed a lot is the way in which the sort of the different forms of oppression that appear to have a racist kind of element to them are expressed at different sort of phases of history and with different governments. In the previous government led by Kevin Rudd and then Julia Gillard, we actually had what seemed to be the appearance of a very much, you know, a change in approach, and we had that very public apology that Kevin Rudd gave in Canberra. And yet the policies that had actually had been enacted by Howard's government previous to that were continued. The very racist policies of the intervention in the Northern Territory, and then the ongoing policies of welfare quarantining, which continue to this day and which are indeed expanding, continued under Labor. And this is where I think my what I'd really like to get into with you is to try and understand the way in which we seem to be controlled almost by a false dichotomy of left and right in some respects in our country.
Yes, I think we are. Some of us are controlled. I think a lot of people are starting to wake up to the fact that in many of what used to be called the social democracies in Australia, Britain, United States, elsewhere in the world, in Europe, the two so-called mainstream parties have effectively converged. It's a historical process. It's been happening over a long time, but it's speeded up as a certain economic ideology has really consumed both parties. So there's no real difference at all between, in Australia, between the Coalition and the Labor and economics and foreign policy, and certainly not in their attitude to their policies towards the Indigenous people. What there is, and this is very much a feature of today, is public relations. What Edward Bernays, the founder of, or the inventor of the word public relations, which he invented as a euphemism for propaganda, called the invisible government of PR. PR is an enormous power in the world, in our world. It drifts between politics and economic problems and advertising and so on. But when you have policies towards Indigenous people that are matters of life and death for them, often, the use of PR to try and distinguish between the policies of the Coalition and the policies of the Labor is striking. The apology you mentioned was both PR and something that was very important to many Aboriginal people, particularly the older generation. My sense is that the PR side was its strongest element, because when Rudd made that apology, virtually in the same breath, he said, and I quote him, "I want to be blunt about this, there will be no compensation." Mm. Now, had he said that about 100,000 white Australians whose children had been stolen, there would have been a national uproar. He wouldn't have said it, for one thing, because the courts would have been jammed with cases. So, but he felt that he could say it about Indigenous people. And I remember in that week, I was in Australia then, the Sydney Morning Herald had an editorial in which it said, "Mr. Rudd has succeeded in clearing away a piece of political wreckage." That's what they called
Incredible.
It.
Incredible, yeah.
It was a very incisive editorial, actually, because I think it was correct. Political wreckage. And that's been the story of governments, with perhaps the notable exception of elements of the Whitlam government and Fraser governments. That's been generally the political attitude towards Indigenous people. So you had the Howard sort of hit and run national emergency intervention, whatever you want to call it, based on a false premise and with a lot of lurid stories and shaking of fists, as it were. And then you had the Labour government's so-called stronger futures, an Orwellian term, that really only, although there were differences between the two policies, both were covered by the same public relations. So governance, really, there was no change.
Indeed. Another thing that's quite striking about the current situation is that, I mean, I've had several people on this show talking about the ongoing child removals that are still happening to this day using the Department of Community Services. And, of course, it's a large part of that is Aboriginal people, but, of course, it's generally poor people as well. Mm-hmm. And this... This question about policies that are racist tends to also blur into questions about policies that really are about sort of the oppression of the underclass generally. And, of course, Aborigines have generally been at the bottom of the underclass and are predominantly seen in prisons as well. But there's a larger sense, is there not, that what we actually have is it's kind of a controlled society where this underclass is being manipulated and controlled and exploited, but under the nanny state sort of caring system, we're led to believe that this is all done for the greater good. But then when we look at in a past age, we say, well, it was terrible, you know, these are terrible child removals. But of course, in a past age, it was done with the same mentality. Can I just get a quick take on that from you?
Yeah. Well, yes, the nanny state and what's good for you, that's all just nonsense. It's the Australian governments want to, if not destroy, then certainly undermine what's left of remote area Indigenous culture. These people are a nuisance to them. They want to get rid of them. They want to move them into towns. That was what Howard was setting out to do, and that's what the Labor government set out to do, and that's what Abbott will try and do, is to deny these communities basic rights and services and to shift them to so-called hubs, economic hub.
Indeed. Sorry, is the bumper a little too loud there for you? Sorry. We're just going to break you with Truth News Radio Australia. We'll be back after this very short break. Please stay with us. Getting fed up with all the disinformation, deception, spin, propaganda, half-truths and downright lies in mainstream news? Looking for something different? Visit Truth News Radio Australia, www.truthnews.com.au, and may the truth set you free. With Truth News Radio, and my guest today is filmmaker John Pilger, and we are going through some aspects of the new film Utopia, which I believe is screening this month in theatres in Australia. And we're also looking at the issues within the government and society in general in terms of racism and in terms of economic and sort of exploitation of of the underclass. Mr. Pilger, please continue from where you left off. You were cut off there just as we went to break.
I'll just say, Utopia, your listeners will be interested to know, Utopia is actually launched in Australia in January, they can get information on where it's being shown from my website, which is www.johnpilger.com. It's on the homepage. There is the Indigenous premiere of the film is in Redfern and Sydney on the 17th of January. Then there's a big launch at the MCA, the Museum of Contemporary Art in Sydney, leading up to Australia Day, Invasion Day. So people might be interested in that.
Definitely.
I think that these matters of controlling people are very interesting. And people have only just started to become aware that the Indigenous people have been used almost to trial a certain form of control of what you call the underclass, but I would simply say of poor people or disadvantaged people. And by, in a very crude way, giving them the sort of mechanisms of control, like this dreadful basics card, which restricted them to certain shops and really denied them the whole range of life and shopping and benefits and so on other Australians have had. That, of course, has been extended to non-Indigenous people in disadvantaged areas. And it does come back to what I was describing as the almost a universal theme in the film, and that is the division of people between those who are accepted and willing to go along with a material and ideological type of system, a kind of comfort zone. If they're willing to go along with that, and they're not willing to protest against it or exercise other basic rights, then life won't be too bad for them in one respect. On the other side, those who are disadvantaged or poor and who simply are denied entry into this comfort zone, or like a number of Aboriginal people in remote communities simply want to live differently, they are excluded. Now, this is really... this division, this very clear division, is effectively the end of social democracy. Because social democracy, the tenets of social democracy, was that the state, and representing the people, would ensure that all, that is advantaged and disadvantaged, had access to the same rights and services. That's now changed radically, and that's changed with the imposition of extreme economic policies, so-called economic policies, they're political, of course, on extreme forms of financial capitalism and so on communities. So what governments are doing now, they're dealing with the, as they did back in the Victorian times, they're dealing with the poor again. They're sweeping up the poor. They're controlling them. They're not exactly putting them in workhouses or poor houses, but they're controlling them.
Absolutely.
And they're corralling them, and that was basically what the intervention, the so-called national emergency in Indigenous communities, was all about. It's interesting that when you explain this to people, as I tried to do in the film, who are not Australians, so people over here in the UK, they find it shocking.
Yes, when it's in stark relief.
We've got to do is get Australians shocked by it.
Indeed. And another aspect I want to just quickly touch on, you had Chris Graham, I saw in the trailer of your film, Australian journalist Chris Graham, who I've actually had on the show here, and he has quite a shocking story to tell about the media coverage from the ABC. And this is another aspect that you've been very critical of over the years, about the way in which the media is basically fashioning false narratives. And, of course, Chris Graham exposed the way in which the ABC had more or less constructed a completely false narrative about paedophilia in the Central Australian communities, which was then used very effectively to motivate the intervention. And this seems to be part of the playbook now, which is being used not just in Australia, it's being used all around the world. I mean, we saw it in the pretext for the invasion of Libya. We see it in the Middle East with, for example, the situation in Syria. Just a quick take on all of that.
Well, I mean, perhaps we're just waking up to what always was. The romantic idea of the media, used to be called the press, being the fourth estate, checking the other institutions of state, being independent, standing up for the rights of its readers and viewers and listeners. That's simply false. There are honourable exceptions to this. There are many fine journalists who go against a system, but the system basically is that the media is and always has been an extension of established power, established authority. And you only have to go to Canberra in Australia to see how politics are reported. Yes, they'll report scandals and personalities in a apparently independent way, but basically politics are reported as politicians want them reported. And that is, the system is never challenged by journalists. And that's not my reading of what journalism should be. Above all, it should be something that calls authority to account. Now, we've seen very vivid examples, as you suggest, all over the world in recent years, where the media has beat the drums of war. For example, in Iraq, the media played a critical role in ensuring that the invasion of Iraq went ahead, in amplifying the lies that were told in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq. You mentioned Libya, exactly.
Indeed.
That. These so-called humanitarian interventions, which are nothing of the kind, of course, that's a classical... it's a classic PR term, propaganda term. They are promoted by media. So media has become a very, very important part of the so-called New World Order. I think it was the recently departed General Petraeus ran the CIA and was chief of staff in Afghanistan and Iraq. He made it very clear that most of his energies went into the media, and that, in fact, during the last 4 or 5 years, something like $4 billion was spent on propaganda by the Pentagon. There are plenty of other examples. So media...
We're just going to break. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. Sorry to interrupt. We're with Truth News Radio Australia. We're just going to break. We'll be right back. Stay with us. back with Truth News Radio Australia, and I have been talking to filmmaker John Pilger, and we've been getting into some really, really interesting topics. Unfortunately, we have run out of time. Mr. Pilger, thank you so much for making time today. It really is important, and a lot of our listeners will be very, very pleased that you've been able to come on this show, because on this show we really do like to look into every question. We like to expose everything that's going on, and we have many listeners from different sort of political persuasions. So having someone of your stature coming on is a great honour. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for asking me. I've enjoyed it.
Absolutely, and I hope to make it to one of the film screenings soon. Okay, well, I'd like to play for you now the trailer for the film Utopia.
We're about 200 miles from Alice Springs and heading into the red heart of Australia. It's a region known as Utopia, the poorest place in Australia. It's the home of the first Australians.
Society too, they have to do the same as us.
I was waiting for a description of the concentration camp that's here. Historic rottenness, play and stay.
We rounded people up into our own concentration camps. No more whispering
in our mind. Welfare men found us and took us, no, and mothers were screaming and crying and hanging onto the truck when they drove us away.
We've got a lot of racist policies in our past, but this one was the mother of them all.
One less loved one at Christmas. One rule for the whites and one rule for the blacks.
He was just left in his cell to die while the police officers searched for
you now. For the rest. You think you get all the Aborigines on your side?
Every way I can. No
more whispering. I don't believe in nationalism. It gives a false sense of identity of those who have stolen lands of which they now believe that they so rightfully inherit. Rise up to make a change. Stop these killings.
That was the trailer for Utopia, John Pilger's new film, which will be screening in Australian theatres in January, as he said today. Now, I'd like to actually return to the question of government control and interference with people's access to welfare. In the interview there, we were talking a little bit about welfare quarantining and the basics card. Now, it turns out that the coalition government wants to expand welfare quarantining in Australia. Now, for those who don't know what that word means, welfare quarantining is a system of basically withholding certain payments or a certain percentage of payment from people who are on benefits and then forcing you to spend that money in a certain way or on certain things. I've got an article here from The Australian from October this year. A wider cross-section of welfare recipients in more disadvantaged communities across Australia will be forced to use their payments on essentials such as food, rent and clothing under an Abbott government plan to expand income quarantining. Social Services Minister Kevin Andrews has ordered a fast-tracked interim evaluation of five existing welfare quarantining trials. The Coalition believes the scheme is too limited. And there are currently trials in place in Shepparton, Victoria, Bankstown, New South Wales, Rockhampton in Queensland, and Playford in South Australia. The Coalition has declared the trial a failure, in that it is too reliant on people agreeing to sign up and does not do enough to force parents who have failed to care for children into the scheme. Under the scheme implemented by the previous Labor government, a person could be forced onto income management if they were referred to by a state or territory child protection authority, a Centrelink social worker, or in cases where they had rental arrears greater than 1 month, a state housing authority. Volunteers have 50% of their benefits quarantined to be spent on food, rent, clothing and other essentials using basics cards. Those forced into the scheme have 70% of their benefits quarantined. Now let's talk a little bit about the basics card, folks, because this is really is where it gets nasty. The basics card is a card issued to you. It's like a credit card. It's like a bank card, but it is a card that is really a product of a fusion between the government and mega corporations, which you can only use in certain establishments. And when you do use it within those establishments, you can only use it to buy certain things. Now, as John Pilger said in our interview there in the last segment, it seems that we are entering into a new phase of Western civilization where a subclass of human beings is created that are somewhat detached from the citizenry, from the enfranchised public. You could call them a disenfranchised underclass. And these people are just being managed as if more or less that they are cattle. Of course, technically they can still vote, but their choices in life are narrowed and narrowed and narrowed. And of course, these people, being poor, being underprivileged, are forced to live largely on the government benefits that are provided. So there is this huge class of people that is completely under the control of our government systems. I'm going to play you a clip now from commercial television from about a year ago on the subject of the basics cards on a show by the name of Today Tonight.
Well, first tonight, we look at a radical system designed to give Centrelink more control over who gets welfare and how they use it. And depending on your point of view, the new basics card is a sensible strategy to protect the most vulnerable or an outrageous government attack on the rights of individuals. As Damien Hansen reports, it could be a welfare revolution or a welfare revolt.
As of next year, they're trying to give us all a card.
What, for money? No, forget that.
Australia is becoming a nanostate.
They can punch this, it's no good.
We're on the pension, mate.
The Basics card is a PIN-protected card that lets you spend your income-managed money.
It's Big Brother at the ATM. A $120 million social experiment rolling out at shopping centres at the cash register, targeting our most vulnerable, the unemployed, the sick, the elderly.
I think it's a card of shame. It shames and humiliates people who don't deserve it.
They're trying control us in every way.
Mate, why don't they just give us like a you know, one
I
of them?
I might as well just pull my pants down and bend over now.
And the people this card could soon control are not happy.
And if they bring this in, I'm telling you, there'll be riots everywhere.
You can use your Basics card to buy things you need, such as food, clothes.
The Basics card is an income management scheme which dictates to blacklisted Centrelink recipients what they can and can't spend their benefit on.
You cannot use your Basics card to purchase alcohol, tobacco or tobacco products, pornography, homebrew kits or homebrew concentrate, gambling products or services, or gift cards or vouchers.
Income management is being implemented in 5 locations: Bankstown in New South Wales, Logan and Rockhampton in Queensland, Playford in South Australia, and Shepparton in Victoria. We found this basics kiosk in a shopping centre in Bankstown. The government aims to stop people spending their payments on alcohol, tobacco and gambling. The Minister for Families, Community Services and Indigenous Affairs, Jenny Macklin.
It is a helpful tool to make sure that we see food put on the table and people's rent being paid.
You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia. I'm playing you a clip from Today Tonight investigation into Centrelink's basic card. We are going to break. We'll be right back. Stay with us. With Truth News Radio. And I'm playing to you a clip from a commercial television investigation into Centrelink's basic card, the Today Tonight Show. Not normally renowned as a great show for investigative journalism, but every now and then we do get some interesting material coming out of this medium, and I think this is an example of one such case. And certainly they're getting into a lot of the aspects of why this is so offensive and humiliating to people. Of course, the fundamental problem here is one of universal human rights, and it is about the abuse of people's basic freedom. Of course, many people will argue that that it's good, because why should people spend their government benefits on alcohol and tobacco and these things that are bad for you? And of course, this is the endless refrain of those who prop up the nanny state, is that it is good for you, it is producing a better future. It is for the greater good, even though in some ways it may be bad in that it is limiting people's freedoms, it is creating a greater good. Now, where of course that all falls down is in a number of ways. Partly there is the problem of the very, very tight intermesh between the government system, the money that flows, and the companies that are basically within that system that you can use the card with. You see, with real money, paper money, you can spend that wherever you want. Therefore, it's an open system and anyone can participate. You can use it's a medium of exchange. It's legal tender, right? And that's how the economy works. You use your legal tender to buy products and services from anyone you choose. But with a system like this, which now under coalition they're trying to expand, really it creates a two-tiered system. That there is one monetary system for these people on benefits and another monetary system for people who are, I guess, free people. So it's like there is now to be the enslaved people and there are the free people. And, I mean, that is just so against the basic principles of human freedom and human rights, that the fact that it's gone this far and that these trials are now expanding and they're seriously planning to extend this to the whole of Australia is truly frightening. And of course, remember, this all began with the Northern Territory intervention. And that's why these issues about racism and the use of racial profiling to bring in measures of totalitarian control are so important. But what I like to do is to always look at the bigger picture, see where this is going. Racism has always been used as a tool. Racism has never been an end game in itself. So let's just continue now with this clip from Today Tonight on Centrelink's basic card. And they're interviewing here Jenny Macklin, who actually was the representative, the minister from the previous government, no longer in power.
Who will be put on the scheme?
Well, for example, somebody who hasn't been paying their rent, who's in danger of being evicted. I think it's much better that somebody gets help to manage their money through the basics card rather than get evicted. Somebody getting the basics card rather than losing their child.
What is the track record of income management systems in Australia?
Well, what we found in Western Australia is that it's worked, that people have been able to get their finances in order, make sure that they get food on the table, that they can actually pay their bills, and that's the purpose of it.
I'm devastated.
I'm not giving my money up.
Jamie and Roxine Beveridge are both on the disability pension. They're preparing for the fight of their lives.
If I'm a drinker, which I'm not, but say I was and I wanted a cask of wine, big deal, $6, $7 a week.
As long as our rent's paid and our electricity's paid, we should be entitled to spend the money on whatever we choose to spend it on, as long as it's not on drugs.
How often do you come down to the club, mate?
Mate, whenever I can, which is very often.
We found 37-year-old Stuart Holt, who's on JobSeeker benefits, drinking and playing pool at his local club.
Mate, we go looking for work. I go down to Centrelink every single day, look for work, go through the newspapers and that. They've got nothing. They don't know what they're doing. So when I come here, all I want is salvation.
But that salvation might be sunk. Stuart's habit of two packs of smokes a week and two beers a day at the local club could see him on the basics card blacklist.
I'm pissed off. You can't do that. Never ever tell somebody what to do, eh? This is the land of the free and that's it.
When I first went onto the basic card, it was like, what the hell, what's this crap? You know, what? You know, my money's being locked away, I can't touch it.
But Leanne Plath volunteered for income management in Perth. She's had her New Start allowance of $568 a fortnight filtered through her basics card.
But then I started realising it stopped that compulsive spending where, you know, I really didn't need to do it.
It's been great for the budget.
Once I got into a routine, everything started running smooth. I had heaps of food in the house, bills were getting covered, rent was covered, and everything was running really well.
We know that income management doesn't work, and that's the issue. We know from all the research and from speaking to everyone that it doesn't actually help them buy better food and look after themselves better.
Social worker and executive officer of Woodville Community Services, Pam Babkin, is fighting the social reforms as part of the coalition of no income management, not in Bankstown, not anywhere.
I also have a concern that once you're over 18 in this country, you do have a right to buy alcohol. You have a right to gamble and you indeed have a right to look at pornography. But these cards treat adults like children.
I'll just leave it there. I think that point is so important and really can't be emphasised too much, is that we have a right to do certain things that are not illegal, and unless we now see that there are two laws, two systems, two currencies, a two-tiered society, just as John Pilger was saying. I mean, this is so serious, ladies and gentlemen. I mean, this is something that needs a revolution. Unfortunately, we do need a revolution. And just on a final note today, I'd actually like to talk about a revolution that is actually brewing in another country, Thailand. And I bring it up because I want to highlight the fact that Australia has a very, very low level of engagement in democracy. We very rarely get out and hit the streets on a topic, on an issue that's very important. And when we do, it's usually in really minuscule numbers. Activist groups work against a huge kind of a complacence within the society. By contrast, in Thailand, we have a situation now brewing there with a popular movement calling for a revolution. And the reason why is because the government there has become completely corrupt, so they say. The current prime minister is the sister of the ousted former leader, Thaksin Shinawatra, who was actually found guilty of several charges of corruption but fled the country before he could serve jail time. And in the last few days, there have been millions of people turning out onto the streets in Bangkok. This, of course, actually has been brewing for a long time, actually for several years, but in the last 6 months, it has been growing and growing and growing. And what we've seen in Thailand is just an incredible political awakening. The masses there are not going to put up with their way of life being undermined, and the sort of totalitarianism that came with the previous government, which is now kind of edging its way back, a dictatorial way of running the society. Now, I have a clip here from Deutsche Welle Radio covering the latest developments in the Bangkok protest.
Demonstrators celebrated after a show of strength on Monday. They forced their way into two major government compounds, the Ministries of Finance and Foreign Affairs. The protesters called on civil servants to walk off the job and join the anti-government rallies. The mood here was peaceful. But earlier in the day, it was a different story on the streets, with violent clashes between police and some of the tens of thousands of demonstrators. Protest leader Suthep Thaugsaban is determined not to give up the fight.
I invite protesters to stay here overnight at the finance ministry. I urge others to do the same and seize other government offices around the country.
In response, the Thai government has invoked a special security law, which gives police the right to block routes, impose a curfew, ban gatherings, and carry out searches. But Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawat is also keen to show restraint.
Our security services are monitoring the protests. We're trying to handle the demonstrators without violence. We don't want to see any violence.
The protests are directed against both the Prime Minister and her brother, Thaksin Shinawat, who's been living in exile since being convicted of corruption in 2008. Protesters say he's still pulling the political strings in Thailand. They've vowed to keep fighting and take over more government buildings.
So there we have it. The popular will in Thailand is alive. The masses are awakened. These protests in the Bangkok city centre have been absolutely enormous. One only wishes to see something within Australia that could even begin to approach that. We have so many issues in our country that are extremely important for democracy. Issues of corruption, issues of power, issues of the government-controlled media distorting information. So I'd just like to go with that message today. Look around the world. See what other people have done. You can do it. You can make a difference. There will be no hour two for today's show, but I will be back next week. It has been awesome talking to you. We will be playing in the second hour a replay of one of our recent shows. Do stay tuned. Truth News Radio Australia, beaming out to you on the 27th of November 2013. Welcome to another show, ladies and gentlemen. Well, I have a really important guest today, and I'm very privileged and honoured to be able to bring to you the legendary filmmaker John Pilger, who is going to be talking to us about his latest film project, and I'm also hoping to talk about some of the broader issues about truth in media and what is really going on in terms of the way information is being disseminated on this planet. John Pilger, welcome to Truth News Radio.
Oh, thank you. I'm sorry, but you have to turn down the...
Oh, I'm terribly sorry. Yes, we'll turn that music down a little. It sometimes actually overwhelms the audio. Welcome to the show. I know you're very busy, so we won't keep you too long, but I'd like to start with your latest film, Utopia, which you've had a career in really deeply criticising many aspects of Australian culture and a lot of what is going on in the world in terms of our inherent racism. And what I find about your work that's also really important is that you relate that back to a problem in our society which is really neither of the left or the right. It's a very, very deep problem. It seems to be a problem that we see globally as well. And I'd like to get into all of that. But if you can actually start with talking about this new film that you've just produced and its background and what it contains.
Well, Utopia is the fourth film I've made in Indigenous Australia. The first one was The Secret Country in 1985. And what I wanted to do was to go back to some of the places that I'd filmed back then, meet again some of the people I'd interviewed, and see just really what had changed. That was one aspect of it. I also wanted to just look at how the media especially plays a significant role in the popular portrayal of Indigenous people. People from outside Australia are often very puzzled about why Australians, non-Indigenous Australians, seem to reserve a particular almost animosity for the First People. It's not down to people who might be called rednecks. It's people of quite enlightened persuasion often have this almost a block about Aboriginal people. And you mentioned in your introduction the racism that runs through Australian society, that's often expressed about the Indigenous people, and of course it's expressed in the political impositions and social engineering and exploitation of Indigenous people as well. So Utopia really examines those elements, and I think, again, as you mentioned, it's a universal story. It's about what has become a kind of international apartheid, the word borrowed from South Africa, an apartheid between classes and people of race, racial difference, mainly apartheid between the rich and the poor, and between those who are prepared to conform to a kind of ideological and material doctrine or comfort, and those who are not. And that's very much expressed in the story of the Indigenous people of Australia.
Indeed. And, you know, one thing that that I've certainly noticed a lot is the way in which the sort of the different forms of oppression that appear to have a racist kind of element to them are expressed at different sort of phases of history and with different governments. In the previous government led by Kevin Rudd and then Julia Gillard, we actually had what seemed to be the appearance of a very much a change in approach, and we had that very public apology that Kevin Rudd gave in Canberra, and yet the policies that had actually had been enacted by Howard's government previous to that were continued. The very racist policies of the intervention in the Northern Territory, and then the ongoing policies of welfare quarantining, which continue to this day and which are indeed expanding, continued under Labor. And this is where I think what I'd really like to get into with you is to try and understand the way in which we seem to be controlled almost by a false dichotomy of left and right in some respects in our country.
Yes, I think we are. Some of us are controlled. I think a lot of people are starting to wake up to the fact that
in many of what used to be called the social democracies in Australia, Britain, United States, elsewhere in the world, in Europe, the two so-called mainstream parties have effectively converged. It's a historical process. It's been happening over a long time, but it's speeded up as a certain economic ideology has really consumed both parties. So there's no real difference at all between, in Australia, between the Coalition and the Labour and economics and foreign policy, and certainly not in their attitude to their policies towards the Indigenous people. What there is, and this is very much a feature of today, is public relations. What Edward Bernays, the founder of, or the inventor of the word public relations, which he invented as a euphemism for propaganda, called the invisible government of PR. PR is an enormous power in the world, in our world. It drifts between politics and economic problems and advertising and so on. But when you have policies towards Indigenous people that are matters of life and death for them, often, the use of PR to try and distinguish between the policies of the Coalition and the policies of the Labour is striking. The apology you mentioned was both PR and something that was very important to many Aboriginal people, particularly the older generation. My sense is that the PR side was its strongest element, because when Rudd made that apology, virtually in the same breath, he said, and I quote him, "I want to be blunt about this, there will be no compensation." Mm. Now, had he said that about 100,000 white Australians whose children had been stolen, there would have been a national uproar. He wouldn't have said it, for one thing, because the courts would have been jammed with cases. So, but he felt that he could say it about Indigenous people. And I remember in that week, I was in Australia then, the Sydney Morning Herald had an editorial in which it said, "Mr. Rudd has succeeded in clearing away a piece of political wreckage." That's what they called
Incredible.
It.
Incredible, yeah.
It was a very incisive editorial, actually, because I think it was correct. Political wreckage. And that's been the story of governments, with perhaps the notable exception of elements of the Whitlam government and Fraser governments. That's been generally the political attitude towards Indigenous people. So you had the the Howard sort of hit and run national emergency intervention, whatever you want to call it, based on a false premise and with a lot of lurid stories and shaking of fists, as it were. And then you had the Labour government's so-called stronger futures, an Orwellian term, that really only, although there were differences between the two policies, both were covered by the same public relations. So governance, really, there was no change.
Indeed. And another thing that's quite striking about the current situation is that, I mean, I've had several people on this show talking about the ongoing child removals that are still happening to this day, using the Department of Community Services. And, of course, it's a large part of that is Aboriginal people, but, of course, it's generally poor people as well.